tonight on Arena. Lisa Tadeo on her debut novel, Animal, and in movies, Another Round, French Exit, and the documentary Jackie Collins' Lady Boss. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we begin this evening, as usual, with film reviews. And it's great to be able to say again, films that are actually going to be in actual cinemas. Up first is Another Round from Thomas Vinterberg. We spoke to him on the programme on Tuesday. His film stars the ever-charismatic Mads Mikkelsen as Martin, who, along with his band of middle-aged friends, sets about testing his limits as a drinker of alcohol. Michelle Pfeiffer is back as a brittle New York socialite hit with hard times, who decides to go off to Paris with her grown-up son. That film is French Exit. And we have a feature documentary about the fabulous life of one of the world's most successful and glamorous novelists in Lady Boss, the Jackie Collins story. Donald Clark, Ruth Barton are with me this evening. And let's start with Another Round, which won the Oscar this year for Best International Feature, and which, it has to be said, is certainly thought-provoking and lingers in the mind long after the final credits have disappeared. Donald, the basic setup here, the men at the heart of it who are going to test this kind of scientific theory around alcohol.
Yeah. This is a real theory, apparently. Though when I talked to Vinterberg, he was sort of vague about how seriously it should be taken. Yeah. But a Norwegian scientist called Finn Skjerderud has come up with this notion that human beings essentially have insufficient alcohol in their blood system when they're at a resting state, as it were, and that we should get our blood alcohol percentage up to about 0.5%, which is a little less than what would count as intoxication in most Western countries. And the film concerns four teachers who are reached a stage of middle age when they're uncertain about everything, as we all do at that point in life. Their students aren't satisfying them, their home lives aren't satisfying them, something has gone awry, and so they decide to try this plan out. Now, it's an interesting approach to addressing the topic of drinking in the European society, in that we're quite used to the notion that that such attempts to do this basically always come down ultimately on the fact that alcohol is bad, is a bad thing, and you shouldn't do it. And the same way, the same kind of problem you often have with drug education schemes, and they always struggle with the awkward reality that intoxication can be a blast. I mean, that's what people do it in the first place.
Yeah.
And in this case, they also do allow in the notion that, yes, under certain conditions, that alcohol can help you function in certain areas, which is a very iffy notion that people might be a little bit uncomfortable with. But for example, in the case of Mads Mikkelsen, his initial when he initially starts teaching under the mild influence of alcohol, things do get a bit better. And certain aspects of their lives do improve.
Yeah, and certainly we get examples, and Vinterberg talked to me about this as well when he was speaking with us. We get examples of Churchill and Roosevelt as leaders who drank and did reasonably well in certain aspects.
Yeah.
And then Hitler, who didn't drink. And I think that tells its own story. But the other thing that's interesting here, Ruth, when we spoke to Thomas Vinterberg, he was particularly interesting, I thought, on the contrasting reasons why young people might be abusing alcohol as to the reasons why older people might be doing the same thing.
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting when he was talking about that, because he was talking about the need to release yourself and to become uninhibited. And of course, we know that, you know, generally in the general population, creativity is released by alcohol. It's a disinhibitor. But what he was saying about young people is they're so surveilled, if that's the right word, they're so watched through social media. So they have to exercise so much restraint because of social media that the only way that they could let go is through alcohol. Now, I don't know if he got this theory from a Norwegian philosopher. I think it's his own. You know, and that's his idea. And then so it is different for the youngsters who bookend this film, because we see them. This is apparently a very particular Danish rite of passage, which is when you leave secondary school, you go on this total group binge. And if you throw up, then your group gets a time disqualification, or, you know, also very ritualized, which is funny because it is a very restrained drinking session.
Yeah.
But that is his idea, that, yeah, that they need it.
The other thing, Donald, is, you know, I kind of wondered what you think and what the viewer is supposed to feel around these four middle-aged men. And I suppose some of this is down to the performances, for sure. Mads Mikkelsen, a regular collaborator with Vinterberg, and Thomas Bo Larsen in there as well. But do you think we were meant to see kind of different aspects of middle-aged ways of dealing with drink? Were we supposed to condemn them? Were we supposed to feel okay about them?
Well, I think that there's a contrast between how the Mikkelsen character is dealt with and how the characters around him are dealt with. They are quite drawn in quite broad strokes, I would say, the characters around him. Whereas with him, you do get a genuine attempt to try and connect with the upsides and the downsides to this. Having said, as I said earlier on, or implied as I implied earlier on, that there's no kind of broad morals to here, there kind of is, because at the centre of the film is a point at which he connects with his wife on holiday, and that is partly due to the fact that they've got away from the world, and it's also partly due to the fact that he is sober. It's partly the fact that she is connecting with the real guy. I think the other characters are done pretty much broad strokes. And again, having said that there's more balance here than you'd expect from a Hollywood film on this subject, they do, most of them, end in pretty bad place. Along the way, they occasionally accomplish something when they're in the throes of the experiment, but they all end up in a pretty bad way, more or less.
Yeah, but
the ultimate notion.
Yeah, we are talking about.
But I think the.
Go ahead. No, finish the point, Donald.
No, the final full stop, which I don't know if we can talk about, but the final scene, which has become rather famous, ultimately does, after all this kind of like faint soft pedal moralizing, turn around and say, yeah, but you know what, this stuff is fun and we do it because it's fun.
Yeah, I'll mention something about that a bit later on. Ruth, this is going to be remade in the US starring Leonardo DiCaprio.
No. Oh my goodness, you know, the mind just boggles. I just can't believe, because Leonardo DiCaprio, I mean, I know he's done some edgy roles, but I don't see him having the same subtlety of expression, for instance, as Mads Mikkelsen, because, you know, as Donald was saying, one of the things about Mads Mikkelsen, although it's an ensemble piece, he's the star. And he's got, you know, he's got an incredible mouth, Mads Mikkelsen, and he only has to slightly twitch it to see a whole range of emotions. Leonardo DiCaprio has the blandest, smoothest Hollywood face. And also, you know, Hollywood is so puritanical. If you go over the line, you're punished. And you know, as we're kind of coming to discuss, the film says, well, actually, it can be really liberating. Yeah. And it produces this fantastic finale. I loved it. Yeah, because I hadn't known that Mads Mikkelsen was a dancer, but now I do.
Well, I wonder, is Leonardo DiCaprio a dancer, or is he taking dancing lessons as we speak? Because there is this big, effectively, dance sequence is the only way you could describe it at the very end of the piece. Donald, is it a case that it fits in with the film? I have a sneaky suspicion Mads Mikkelsen can dance, therefore we might as well let him dance, because he was a dancer in the early part of his career.
He was. He was a professional dancer before he became a professional actor. One would love to see him and Christopher Walken in a dance number together. The two of them are two sort of unlikely actors who come from that background. Both of them were. I think it seems to me a cheeky swivel at the last minute, because which would be trickier for an American film to pull off, which that is a more puritanical environment, American cinema. Yeah. Whereas in this case, it was a very cheeky turnaround. And having got to a stage where the film has sort of come to the conclusion that, like, this is a bad idea and that alcohol is ultimately more of a problem than it is a boon, it turns around and says, look, here we are kind of running up and down the court, being drenched in champagne and dancing in the most extravagant manner fashionable. And I think that's a wonderful subversion of a lot of what's gone before in the previous sort of 30 minutes of the film.
Right, so stars from you, Donald, first.
Four
from you, and then proving that he can use more than his mouth in that final sequence for sure. Ruth, his entire body is involved in the performance from Mads Mikkelsen. What are you saying overall, and stars, Ruth?
Oh, I just loved it, and I think that final sequence, because it ends in that classic cinematic moment, which is the final freeze frame of him jumping into, and so it's, you know, what have you done? Have you paused life? Or is it going to go on afterwards? I thought it was fantastic. I loved it. Four as well.
Four from Ruth. So that's our first of our films this evening. Another round. Let's move on to French Exit, adapted from the novel of the same name by Patrick DeWitt, directed by Azazel Jacob, starring Michelle Pfeiffer, Lucas Hedge, Valerie Mahaffey and Imogen Poots. Pfeiffer, a rich New York socialite who finally finds herself with very little money. In fact, let's start off with a clip which is the moment when she goes to speak with her lawyer, in fact, Mr. Baker, played by Robert Hidgen. And this is how she finds out her financial situation at this moment.
It's all gone.
What's all gone? Not the money in my account.
It's not your account for long.
It's in my name.
The name you get to keep, but every penny in that account, in addition to the investments and properties, are going back to the bank.
The properties?
You'll be locked out on the 1st of January at the latest.
Certainly I'll be able to keep the money I brought to the marriage.
That was shuffled into the estate a long time ago, and it wasn't, excuse me, a very large sum.
And Malcolm's legacy?
No. I spoke to you about this as a possibility for 7 years and then an eventuality for three. What did you think was going to happen? Francis, what was your plan?
My plan was to die before the money ran out, but I kept and keep not dying, and here I am.
Michelle Pfeiffer. In a scene there from French Exit as Francis Price, the now pretty broke or about to be broke Francis Price. Ruth, at one level, you know, this idea of the New York socialite who had plenty of money, acerbic, witty and surrounded by people with loads of money, it's not a new story. Is Patrick DeWitt, or indeed this film as directed by Azazel Jacobs, is that bringing anything new to the genre?
I didn't really think so, to be honest. I mean, it is a pastiche, so it takes something that we're very familiar with, that we've seen many times before, as you say, and you can think, you know, you can go right back to kind of, you know, Jazz Age stuff and all this stuff about wealthy socialites, which is kind of a fantasy world. And, you know, even recently I was thinking this film bears some resemblance to that thriller, The Undoing, with Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant in it. Mm. Very, very mannered, very stylized, but ultimately very empty. And this is, I think, the undoing of this film, because it's pastiching, it's copying all these styles. It puts them up on screen, but it doesn't have the kind of the kind of class of, say, a Wes Anderson film, and I think he's quite indebted to Wes Anderson. And also Patrick DeWitt, who wrote The Sisters Brothers, which, again, I read that novel, I saw that film. I liked it much better than this, because I think they made it, they gave it a kind of identity of its own, whereas this feels more like, yeah, you know, a lot of other things sort of cobbled together.
Yeah, I found myself about an hour into this saying, oh, it's about to start now. I think we're finally in Paris, or maybe we're on the boat or on the way to Paris.
Yeah, and why were they on a boat as well? Yeah. Why didn't they fly? You know, it's got this kind of feeling of Parisness, this very glamorous liner, and you know, various things happen on the liner that are moderately funny. But why did they fly?
Yeah, it is an aspect of it, Donald, and I wondered to what extent are many of the problems the old chestnut here. Book to screen is such a difficult thing to do, and certainly don't try to put all of the book onto the screen, because you'll get lost.
Yeah. I think whenever you think maybe that worked better in the book, you know something's gone a bit wrong. And that, I think my major concern with the film was about sort of halfway through, or a little more than that, there's a sudden shift when to that point it's been peculiar and skewed, but then we get this shift into the explicitly supernatural, and I didn't think the ground was laid for that in the film. Maybe it's laid for that in the book, but that was one of the stages where I thought maybe that worked better in the book. And if you're saying that something's gone wrong, that said, I did quite enjoy it. It's in a peculiar place, and we've hinted at this already, in that it is self-consciously odd, but it still occupies a very familiar world. I mean, it's that off-centre humour and New York upper crust origins put it into the universe of J.D. Salinger and Woody Allen. We mentioned Wes Anderson. And as much as anything else, the New Yorker magazine and its cartoon. It's pure New Yorker, this stuff. So many of the shots here, not least those involving talking cats, you can sit comfortably on the pages of that magazine above the review of a sushi restaurant they're never going to attend. I didn't mind that. I mean, I'm quite happy to be in that world, even if I've been there before. And the main recommendation for it is Michelle Pfeiffer, who is in a very interesting position. Like, watching this, I'm thinking, when did she pull this off? When did she go from being a strong leading lady who deserved better material, which is where she was for a decade or so, to this dynamic, slightly frightening middle-aged treasure in the mold of Joan Crawford, which is where she suddenly seems to be? Yeah. I mean, I'm going to say that Darren Aronofsky's Mother was maybe the turning point, the stage where we looked at her and thought, oh, I'm really looking forward to this next act. She even managed to be good in that dreadful remake of Murder in the Orient Express. And this is... the role is a perfect role for the current version of Michelle Pfeiffer, the formerly rich woman who seems keen on perfecting the art of being utterly impossible, sort of person who drives everyone crazy, but you still can't help admiring.
And you want
and
to
the sort
go,
of woman who,
want...
when travelling from New York to France, does travel on a ship. I think you kind of have to travel on a ship because we're in that world. I mean, people don't use aeroplanes here. They barely use mobile phones. So I think she kind of has to travel on a ship for that reason.
An important aspect of the plot, though, is quite definitely the mother-son relationship. Michelle Pfeiffer is the mother in question here, and Malcolm the son, played by Lucas Hedges. Would you want your mother to be telling you this now?
Well, it wasn't planned, of course. I thought I couldn't have children. I'd never wanted one. Then, when it happened, we thought your presence could help us come together, and you were a last-ditch effort, in effect. But then, when he saw you, it clarified something for him. And he turned away forever from you and me, both.
But I shouldn't hate him?
Your father is an emotional moron, but he isn't evil.
What happened when you saw me?
Oh, I've never been so hurt by something in my life as when I saw your face for the first time.
Why?
Because you were your father. Because you were me. Because you were all three of us. So ruinous.
Michelle Pfeiffer as Frances Price and Lucas Hedges as her son Malcolm there in that conversation about the time of his birth. She has that acerbic touch to her, but that clip gives us a sense in some ways, Ruth, that there are layers to the mother-son relationship that are in the telling here and in the showing. Is it? How would you characterise the relationship? How disturbing is it?
You know, it could have gone further because there is a nice hint, and there's also, you know, mention of him being a gigolo later. You know, he's mistaken for her gigolo later on in the film. And there's a nice hint that this slightly edges on being an incestuous relationship, but it doesn't push it. It just drops it in, and it leaves it wafting in this, you know, smoke-filled air that surrounds all these characters. But she is, she is really a good mother. She does, we see, rescue him from the boarding school in which he's been dumped as a child. And the Franklin that they refer to is the father. I mean, she's not a very good wife. She does leave him dead in bed and go off skiing for the weekend. But then, of course, he does reappear as a cat. This is a confusing story, but it shouldn't be. So they do have, and I love Lucas Hedges. I think he's a fantastic actor. I remember him, you know, being much younger in Manchester by the Sea, and he does it very well because he does that kind of detached. He responds in a very, you know, call and response way to that detached kind of brittle sort of dialogue between the two.
So did it kind of work for you then, Ruth, and stars?
It didn't really. It left me very cold, and it was too affectless. You know, it's too mannered, too stylized for me. So I gave it 3 minutes. Fine, time ticks by. Acting performances are good, but I just didn't warm to it.
All right, and what are you saying, Donald?
I got all right with it, in spite of the criticisms we've made, which I you know, I agree with both of you in that regard. I did quite like the fact that it is not quite a Paris is Awful film. It does acknowledge some of the dreadful things about that place. I would give it a fairly confident 3.
Fairly confident 3. Let us move on then to Lady Boss, the Jackie Collins story. A documentary exploring the life of the novelist Hollywood whistleblower, and I unfortunately have to say this, younger sister to the actress Joan Collins, which, you know, is kind of one of the big points of the documentary itself. But just for those who aren't of that age or who have decided to forget, just remind us, if you would, I'm asking you this one, Ruth, the place, who Jackie Collins was and the place she had in, I suppose, the 70s and 80s in terms of best-selling books.
Well, when we all used to fly, the place she had was on every top shelf of every airport bookshop in the world. And if she wasn't on the top shelf of the airport bookshop, she was on the top shelf of your supermarket. She was everywhere. She was just this massive bestseller. I mean, everybody knew her name in the 1980s. And I think it's quite timely that this should come out now, because it's a kind of nostalgia trip for those of us who remember her name. I mean, I can't say I did ever read the books, but she was ubiquitous. And part of what made her ubiquitous and part of what this documentary explores very interestingly was her image, the way that she styled herself as a power dresser, but also as a power author. And she really was at the vanguard of celebrity culture and how you promote yourself. I mean, if she had Instagram, she would have just never stopped.
I think she did okay even without Instagram, though.
No, she didn't
to be
need
said.
It, no.
let's have a listen to a clip from the documentary, and it starts here with Martin Jacklow, who is her literary agent. And they're talking about the book Hollywood Wives, and then Jackie Collins' voice comes in a little bit further into the clip.
It was a very simple formula. She would observe things in life and then translate them into books. I could sometimes pick out the characters in her books who were based on real life people.
I think to be successful, you have to write about what you know. And whether I'm lucky or unlucky enough to know a lot about Hollywood, I think it's what I like to write about. And Hollywood Wives is fiction, but of course it is based very much on fact.
Where were you?
There I got to my wife.
You know, people love that. They go, oh, I know who that character is. It's Clint Eastwood. And I go, no. Well, then it's Burt Reynolds. And I go, no, you have to play the guessing game. That's the whole fun of a Jackie Collins book.
Bye-bye.
You know, they know that I'm not some little old lady in Des Moines writing about the Hollywood that I think exists. I'm actually out there in Hollywood doing a lot of research, forcing myself to go to parties and watch the movie stars play.
And that's the voice of Jackie Collins and her literary agent, Martin Jacklow, from the documentary film Lady Boss, the Jackie Collins story. Did you find yourself playing the guessing game as she spoke about and we saw clips and heard parts of the books, Donald? Oh, have we lost Donald there? Perhaps he's gone. I don't seem to have him. And let me come back to you on it, Ruth.
Yes.
The double standard is something that Jackie Collins speaks about in various interviews, because it's all obviously archive material in her case that we're getting in this documentary. She talks about the double standard. Was she making a very serious and important point around the double standard, particularly around sexual behaviour and how men were treated around and thought of around their sexual behaviour, and how women were treated and thought of around their sexual behaviour?
Yeah, I mean, she's absolutely spot on. And not only is that about, you know, general societal attitudes, but also the way that she was treated. And, you know, the film, some of the kind of really quite difficult to watch sequences are when she's later in life, when she's very established, everybody knows the kind of books she writes, which are basically about very beautiful, very rich, very glamorous women who want sex and get it. And that did not chine with the kind of post-80s feminism that the people that they seem to have packed the studios with in these chat shows ascribed to. So here she is, herself, you know, fabulously successful, and these people are just attacking her and saying this is disgusting, and they have Barbara Cartland on saying, oh, I think this is disgraceful. So So absolutely, she's creating characters who want what traditionally men want, but she's also fantastically successful herself, doing something that is considered to be a little bit seedy.
Donald, just you can maybe pick up. I know you're agreeing with something that Ruth's major point there, I think, but you might also touch on how the sister relationship with Joan Collins is presented in this documentary.
Well, I think we have to kind of take her at Joan Collins at her word that the conversations about the tensions between them were somewhat exaggerated. And I mean, you know, she's a decent actress, Joan Collins, but I believe that she was moved at the end, as she seems to be. I mean, I agree that the sequence that I found just kind of really infuriating was the chat show with Robert Kilroy Silk. Where you have all these sort of curtain twitchers and self-righteous moralists, and then this younger woman who basically says to Jack Collins, she's not allowed to call herself a feminist. I would great admiration for Jackie Collins for not telling her to go to blazes. I mean, she's every right to call herself a feminist, even though she clearly comes from the more kind of red in tooth and claw, all for yourself school of women's liberation rather than that which is supporting the sisters. Nonetheless, she can be that. Yeah. And I thought she emerged as a very impressive character all the way through. And I think something else which comes through, which isn't perhaps stressed enough, and an extraordinary phenomenon, is the extent to which these two sisters helped create a version of the 1980s. That the same time as that she was writing these books, well, she'd obviously been there for writing books for a decade, but when she wrote Hollywood Wives and then subsequently the miniseries emerged, that was solidifying a certain kind of 1980s, of vulgar 1980s capitalism that became to define the era, in the same way that Dynasty, as they would say, at Joan Collins. And these were two women who were born in the 30s, and I think that was kind of a remarkable thing that in middle age they came to do that.
Let me ask Ruth a final question and stars on this one, Ruth. There's a contributor towards the end. We hear from her sister, her brother, we hear from her daughters and lots of people who worked for her who are all very positive about her. But there's a sequence towards the end when somebody says, let's see the real Jackie here. But while they kept telling me that this was a fabrication or this was a kind of persona, I don't know that I got behind the persona anyway, in any way, shape or form.
No, I kept waiting for that revelation too, and then I realised, much later on that I wasn't going to get it. And the only thing, I did enjoy this, but we are very much locked into a very celebratory view of Jackie Collins because the project was initiated by her daughters, they're the main contributors, and so are family and friends. Yeah. And so I would have loved a few more different voices. I'd have loved to hear actually the fans. I'd have really loved to hear people say why I read Jackie Collins and what I get from it. I'd have loved a little bit more from the outside. About
stars from you, Ruth?
I gave it 3.5. I enjoyed it. I think it does exactly what it promises to do.
And what are you saying overall, Donald, and stars?
I'll give it 4. I really enjoyed it, I have to say. I mean, it left me maybe wanting a twin biography of the two sisters because they're so intertwined. But nonetheless, I really enjoyed it and I was very impressed by her and give it a happy 4.
All right, so that's Donald Clark and Ruth Barton there on our films this evening. Another Round and French Exit are on general release from tomorrow. And Lady Boss, the Jackie Collins story, will go into the IFI and will be available on IFI at Home from tomorrow. In 2019, Lisa Tadeo's debut book, Three Women, became a publishing and a cultural sensation. For 8 years, Tadeo researched and wrote the non-fiction work. She travelled across America 6 times, embedding herself in these three women's lives in order to present the truth of their sexual and emotional experiences. Lisa Tadeo has now returned with a work of fiction, her debut novel, Animal. And in fictional mode, she has lost none of her candour. Thematically, Animal marks a logical progression from its predecessor, exploring trauma, the male gaze, the influence of childhood attachments on relationships throughout life. It also shares its predecessor's intensity and the unflinching frankness that's chimed with readers who perhaps see themselves reflected in the stories. And delighted to have Lisa Tadeo join me on the programme this evening. You might tell me just a little bit to put Animal in some sort of context for our listeners, Lisa. The narrator here, Joan, who describes herself, who tells us, if I was asked for one word to describe myself, I'd use the word depraved. Tell us about her situation at the beginning of the novel and why she might feel that about herself.
Well, Joan is essentially, which we start off, the novel starts off with a man coming into a restaurant and killing and shooting himself in the head while she's having dinner with another married man, as she tells the reader. And so from the start, we kind of have this feeling that Joan is involved in some unsavory behavior. Her telling the reader that she's depraved is essentially her way of saying what she's afraid people are going to say about her before they say it. So she's telling them first. She's sort of owning the description that she knows people are going to put on her.
Do you think that she is worried about what people might say, or do you think there are reasons why people might feel that?
I think that there are people, the reasons why, I think that anytime someone does, and especially a female narrator in fiction or nonfiction for that matter, does anything that is not considered something that is done with pluck and wit and beauty, despite the fallen grace. Anytime a woman does something naughty, it's we look at it as she's sort of morally unscrupulous. And so Joan is aware of that. And Joan is aware that that the best way to stave off other people calling you names is to call yourself the name first.
It really struck me as we were speaking, and I think you heard our film reviews there, and particularly the review at the end about the Jackie Collins documentary. Jackie Collins back in the 70s and 80s speaking about the double standard around sexual behaviour in women. In some ways, Joan is dealing with precisely the same thing a half a century later, isn't she? This double standard around attitudes to the way a young woman might behave as opposed to a young man.
Yes, it's absolutely, it's frankly shocking to me that it's still like that, specifically with fiction and movies and entertainment and anything that is, you know, that we are meant to watch. It's not like when we read a book or watch a movie, we're not, you know, we're not saying that we want to become friends with this person. This person is as close to us as our brother or sister and has the same attributes as us. What we're doing is hopefully reading something that is going to entertain us and make us see a deeper truth in ourselves, perhaps. That's one of the more vaunted hopes, or feel less alone, a million things. But the notion of likability and the idea that a woman in entertainment, in fiction or, you know, movies needs to be likable is a really strange one for me.
Yeah, because it's often the thing that's bandied about. Do you think it's more bandied about in terms of a female narrator than, you know, do I like this person? Never mind, can I believe them? Just put that to the one side. But do I like them? Do I like the sort of things that they're telling me? And do I like the way they behave? As an author, do you just have to throw that out? Or do you think people should throw that out full stop?
I mean, you know, I think that everyone's a different type of reader and writer, and to each his own. For me, you know, it was important for me to tell the story of this woman who had lost everything from a very early age. And so the sort of the world she fell into, it's like if you're having a really bad day, you know, if you've forgotten, if you've lost your keys and, you know, you're late to pick up your kid from school and, you know, you burn the dinner and all these things kind of happen. For Animal, that's kind of it was about that happening to a life writ large, you know, over the course of something happened and then things kept happening.
Yeah.
And so the idea that someone's unlikable because they are acting depressed and angry and rageful after a lot of things have been torn asunder in their lives, to me it's not like, oh, you know, oh, this person should still be likable. It's, wait, why is this person so angry? And how did that person get there? And that was really what I wanted to explore.
Yeah, and to be fair to Joan, it's a little bit more difficult than perhaps burning the dinner or being late to pick up a kid from school. She has a few bigger things than that on her plate. And we might come back to that. But before we go any further into Animal, I'd like to talk a little bit about Three Women and where the writing of Animal sat in relation to the writing of Three Women, because I think there was a kind of an overlap, certainly in the research possibly for Three Women and what became fictional in Animal.
Yeah, I was writing Animal towards the end of my finishing up of Three Women. I had gone to Boston University to get a master's in fine arts so that I could teach writing if, you know, three women did not do well, I had sunk my entire, you know, a decade of my life into it. And I had nothing but multiple debts to show for it. So I went to get my MFA and I wrote Animal. It was my thesis statement for school. And so I was finishing up Three Women while I was writing Animals. So there were a lot of things that I couldn't put in Three Women because, you know, some of the women wanted certain parts of their lives excised and so on. And so I did certainly, you know, use a number of things from my research as I did from my own life and from the lives of people close to me.
So while I can hear that there was a very, before I go on to that, actually, you must have been quite relieved then when Three Women did not actually prove to be a waste of a decade of your life. The response to it must have been very gratifying.
It was, you know, it was gratifying. It was also very, I think if that had happened in my 20s, I would have been like, woohoo, you know, but something about being, you know, having a child and kind of having to deal with all the facts of just getting my life back together, back to normal and kind of being thrust into touring and all of that. It was a lot. It was its own sort of surprise. It was good, but it was a lot. It wasn't what I expected. I was expecting it to be very modest and to get a teaching job and to have a certain kind of, you know, life.
Yeah, well, I hope there was a bit of a hoo, though, along the way somewhere.
Sometimes, you know, if you knew me better, you would know that I'm not much of a woo-hoo person, no matter what it is, as you can tell from my writing, perhaps.
Well, it has to be said that there's a darkness in Animal, and in many of the characters that we meet in Animal, there's a very dark side to how they behave and what they do. But you mentioned there that some of the stories from your research has then made their way into this. Was that part of the reason? I know you mentioned the MFA and all those things, but was that part of the reason for this shift towards fiction as opposed to nonfiction, where you have to back it up in some way with some kind of fact?
Well, no. I mean, I had always written fiction. I've been writing short stories my whole life, and so I have a collection coming out next year. So fiction was always my first love. Nonfiction was something that I did more so to pay the bills. So Animal was something that I'd always wanted to write.
So then to the specifics, then I've mentioned the character of Joan here. She leaves New York, not surprisingly, after the experience that you described to us in the opening pages of the book, where this man comes into a restaurant and shoots himself there and then in that restaurant. What happens after that is a kind of an unfolding backwards in some ways, although we jump around in time, backwards in Joan's life. When you started the novel, did you know Joan's life right back to the very beginning, or, you know, or have an idea in your head of that? Or did it unfold in front of you as you wrote?
It unfolded in front of me. That's when I write fiction, I don't like to know what's going to happen typically. I like to surprise myself. I like to, in a sense, write for myself as much as I don't outline because I get bored if I know what's going to happen.
So you it's as much a surprise for you, because there are huge surprises towards the end of the book, I think, for the reader, and that's best left to the reader. But I'm interested to hear that they were a surprise for you as well. The move from New York and the specifics of heading off to the Topanga Canyon, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, was there something in that location that attracted you as a writer?
Yes, I had lived. I had lived in Topanga Canyon. I lived in LA when I was researching one of the women for Three Women who didn't make it into the final cut of the book. And I lived in the canyon. I lived in a very similar sort of space to what Joan lived in. I had a my now husband and dog with me, so I was not, you know, in the same sort of space that she was. But I had suffered a lot in my 20s of grief and other sorts of traumas. So I thought to myself, how awful would it have been to suffer those things in this heat, in this dark, hot place? So that was sort of the reason why I thought pushing Joan's experience even more to be in this, because Topanga Canyon is absolutely gorgeous. The landscape is gothic, and steep drops and rattlesnakes and coyotes and wildlife, and it's beautiful, but it's oppressively hot. And there are many, many, many weirdos in the canyons. And so it was a kind of perfect location for what I wanted to achieve.
Yeah, and a few weirdos in animal, it has to be said as well, within the canyons themselves. many of whom seem to be running away from life. Is it that type of place, you know, either fictionally for you in the book or in reality? You know, we have a guy who was a big rap star but doesn't really want to talk too much about that. We have another guy called River. We're not really sure what he's doing there, but he's a young man and he lives in a yurt and seems to have a very good time with several different women in the same yurt. And then we have a landlord called Leonard who really has the most unusual type of sexual experiences that he shares. It kind of just tells Joan about. These are unusual people.
Yeah. I wanted there to be an interesting cast of characters, in a sense, an interesting cast of people that I have seen those types of people throughout my life. But I liked the idea specifically with Leonard, the older man who tells Joan about his sexual past. This idea of of men kind of unburdening themselves, telling their secrets in a certain way, like they wanted not just approval, but kind of like, you know, oh yeah, good, that sounds good. Like, I think that that's something that a lot of women have to deal with. I talked before of a flight to Singapore I took when I was younger. And I spent about the 23 hours or however long it was listening to this man talk to me, sitting next to me and just listening to his whole story. And I've had so many times like that where I didn't stand up for myself and say, and not just men, of course, but it was a man in that case. And it was a man in Joan's case, the idea of someone who's kind of unburdening themselves and their life story on someone else and having the other person kind of have to sit and listen, even if all signs point to, I just want to go to sleep or read a book.
Yeah, leave me alone, please. Tell somebody else your story. Just as we finish up, you mentioned there about your 20s being a particularly difficult time. Your father died in a car accident when you were just 23, and your mum died a few short years later of lung cancer, if I'm right on that. And there were other family tragedies and difficulties in there as well. This idea of the psychic wounds that childhood can cause for people, how important was that in the writing of this, in the writing of Animal, and indeed in the final formation of Joan's character?
It was huge. Animal is a big part of Joan's feelings and the things that Joan experiences. The way that I experienced the loss of my 20s was like I had been mauled to death by a tiger, but I was walking around as though, you know, I didn't have a scratch on me. And so that the sense of grief and the sense of loss and the sense of acute pain that I felt, I wanted to be able to show that, to show what it felt like, that sometimes, you know, you have to show a sort of, sometimes life feels bloody, even if it doesn't look bloody. And showing the blood is sometimes the only way that you can tell people how much it hurts.
Well, you certainly do so in Animal, and it makes a very interesting read for that very reason and for many others as well, if I might say that, Lisa. Finally, what about what's next? You mentioned the collection of short stories. Will that be the next publication? And is there something else already been written, fiction or nonfiction?
Yes. So the short stories will be the next published book. And then I'm also working on a memoir about grief and hope, that will be half memoir and half reported stories like Three Women. And I am also, we are casting the TV show for Three Women, which will be on Showtime, hopefully sometime in 2022.
Wow. Well, you're certainly busy, and it wasn't a wasted decade, very clearly. Lovely to speak with you, Lisa, and the very best of luck with everything you do in the future.
Thank you. To you as well. Have a lovely day.
That's Lisa Tadeo speaking to us there, and her book Animal is out now. It's published by Bloomsbury. John Scott has reason to celebrate 2021. His company Irish Modern Dance turns 30 this year. His annual festival Dancer from the Dance begins online next Monday. This is the third such festival curated by John. Features the art of 30 plus choreographers from the US and Europe, as well as Ethiopia, Nigeria and Japan. Dancers range in age from 6 to 82. One of the choreographers involved this year is Terry O'Connor, whose work Bleed was described by the New York Times as a mesmerising choreographic quilt. It's in the lineup in Dancer from the Dance next week. I'm delighted to have John Scott with me here in studio, and Terry O'Connor joins us down the line from Illinois. Speak to Terry in a moment. John, had you any idea 30 years ago, was longevity on your mind? Because things didn't last very long. From my memory back at that time, things were finishing up, I think.
Yes, I'd been part of Dublin City Ballet. Dublin City Ballet closed down in the mid-80s. I was part of another company, Irish Theatre Ballet, closed down even quicker. And to get to 10 years in a dance company in those days in Ireland seemed to kind of be the writing on the wall. If you got to 10 years, that was it. Like one of those science fiction films where they kill people at a certain age. So I started the company. I had traveled and studied abroad as well, and I was seeing these amazing people, amazing things, and I was also making my own work, and I thought if I had a company I could invite some of these people to come and do things in Ireland with the wonderful Irish dancers I trained with. We had a terrible inferiority complex at the time that we couldn't ever make it, except we were only good enough for a small company in Ireland and it wasn't going to make it. Yeah. And then in my travels, I saw other dancers and I kind of knew that the people I was working with, like Myrna Bloomer, David Bulger, Zelda Quilligan and everything, they could hold their own anywhere.
Yeah.
So I started the work and here we go.
3 decades later, still here and still working. When and where and how did you meet Terry O'Connor or see the work of Terry O'Connor then?
Well, one of my first trips to New York, I saw these posters for a dance performance by Terry O'Connor. I was fascinated by the name. I thought, gosh, this sounds so Irish. And people were raving, you have to see it. Of course, I was flying home the day before he was performing. But then later, I caught up with Terry's work and I saw the first piece of his I saw was Frozen Mommy, which was hilarious, beautiful, moving, completely mystifying, kind of incredible organized madness and beauty. And I started to see all his work after that. Laurie Uprichard, when she was running Dublin Dance Festival in 2008, brought a piece called Rammed Earth to the Smock Alley building. And then Terry also worked with Jean Butler on one of her solos for the Dublin Dance Festival.
Well, so, let's talk to Terry then specifically about a couple of those things. The O'Connor bit, first of all, Terry, we got to get that out of the way. Sorry, is there an Irish connection?
There is, yes. We actually just did our ancestry, and we thought we were from Cork, but we're actually from East Pembroke in Dublin.
All right, okay. That's very posh.
Yeah, my grandfather went there.
Yeah. Posh part of Dublin, that's nice. Now, John mentioned a very interesting word, which I was searching today. I saw a part of Bleed online, which I found many of the things John said. You know, I'm not sure I found it hilarious, but I certainly found it totally engaging, mystifying. But John talked about this organized madness, because that was the thing that struck me most in the choreography that I was watching today. Almost, there are 10 dancers in total involved in the piece, certainly as much of it as I saw, Terry. And there are times when they seem to be moving around the stage totally chaotically. And I know it's not chaotic, but that's the impression you give us. And then you just suddenly flick a switch and they're in these beautiful formations. Is that something that is symbolic or whatever, emblematic of your choreography, would you say that? You know, quick madness and then...
Yeah, one of the things I've been doing with my research is looking at kind of what are the actual qualities that the communicative qualities that choreography actually holds, opposed to those that have been foisted on it by the needs for people to find narrative and cogency. I don't think that choreography has that in its project necessarily. So I'm kind of really relating to consciousness, which has a much less kind of linear reality, and I'm trying to kind of celebrate alternative logics. So, you know, in your mind, you might be thinking of a story, and then halfway through, you have some feeling or something that takes you off the pathway. But we've organized our minds and our fictions to kind of bring all of that into a much more, a neater package. And I'm trying to, like, create a value system that looks at the totalness of consciousness. I wouldn't call it chaos. I would call it, like, everythingness.
Ah, that's more a, yeah.
Than chaos.
I'll take that for sure, everythingness.
Yeah, yeah.
John, in terms of Bleed, how would you Terry, how do you describe what Bleed is, apart from those things that you've just told me, because it has all of those qualities within it? And I think it's a combination of three works, really, is what we're getting here, isn't it?
Yeah. One of the ideas that I think is important in the perception of dance is the fact that, you know, you're always losing the image, it's always going into the memory, yet it exerts pressure forward and becomes a ghost in the mind as you perceive the rest of the dance. And that's a concept of Bleed for me, how your memory of what you've seen kind of sullies what you're seeing at present. And this produces the choreography, not necessarily what I'm doing. So I'm trying to harness that kind of inimitable fact about dance making and bring it into process somehow. So that's a lot of what's going on there. So you might be in something that's referring to, you know, kind of Elizabethan mode, and suddenly that gets eaten by the next thing. Yeah. Yet you're still trying to figure out the thing before it.
Yeah, and that's what I mean about those suddenly turning on a sixpence almost type of thing. John, just to give us a little pressy of some of the other things that are happening, I think Shannos is very important in this year's festival.
Yes, we have a lot of different choreographers and dancers coming from so many different backgrounds. We have Liam O'Scanlon, we have Kira Hayes, we've got Rinoch Ní Níl also working in something that kind of goes between many different things. And I don't know, one of the cliches of Irish dance, and the first festival took place in New York, and the New York people were asking me, you know, what's happening in Ireland? And they had these ideas of, you know, just that Irish dance was step dancing and was maybe some very famous pieces that go on tour. And so we've mixed it. We have Shannos dance, contemporary dance,
many
different types of things to show the whole variety of what Irish dance is.
And Terry's work... I have to go now, John, sorry, because we're just coming to it. But what you've been doing for the last 30 years really is part of what we will get a sense of over the next few days. And that's Dance from the Dance 2021, the Festival of Irish Choreography. It takes place online from the 5th through to the 9th of July, and you'll get full details on IrishModernDanceTheatre.com, and that is our lot for this evening. Paula Shields researched, Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator, Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.